Hello and welcome to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. Today, the Poison Pen is honored to have with us New York Times bestselling author Kristen Higgins, whose new book is A Little Ray of Sunshine. Before we begin, I would like to let those listening in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of Kristen's new book available for purchase, and we would be happy to hold one for you to pick up at the store or put one in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore. Now, I would like to welcome a truly talented and wonderful writer, Kristen Higgins.
Thank you, John. It's so great to see you again and be part of the Poison Pen, one of my favorite bookstores.
It's great having you back. Let's begin by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. I'm always fascinated by authors and what I like to call their origin story before they were writing. Who was Kristen?
Yeah, well, I was pretty much the same person I am now, except I didn't have such a cool career. You know, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, now I'm a grandmother, and I live in a little town in Connecticut and spend a lot of time on Cape Cod, where A Little Ray of Sunshine is set. And I think more than anything, I'm a book lover. I mean, books have paved the path of my life since I was 4 years old. And told my mom, you don't need to read to me. I know what happens next. Learning to read just by looking at books, you know. So I'm a reader who happened to be very lucky and published my first book, you know, something like 18 years ago, 17 years ago. And have, this is my 23rd.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, I feel like my books reflect myself in a way, in that I write about regular people, you know, people with regular jobs and families that are complicated and wonderful and horrible, and who go through the kinds of things that most of us go through. I don't write, you know, about spies and soldiers and vampires. And, you know, I always thought I don't know those people. So let me write about regular folks.
How did you get to become a published author? Because if I remember correctly, you were writing, but it wasn't fiction.
Yeah, I worked in advertising right out of college, public relations and advertising. And that was actually really good training ground for writing fiction because you had to write, for one, you had to write attention-grabbing copy, you know, the headline. If you have a good graphic, people read the headline. If you have a good headline, people read the copy. And also writing on deadline and writing, you know, when you're not particularly inspired or moved, you know, I never believed in like, wait until your muse speaks to you. I haven't met my muse. She has not yet made an appearance. I had written in advertising for, you know, probably 8 or 10 years before I had my kids. And then I was a stay-at-home mom, which was thrilling and wonderful. And when my son was little, when he was like 2 or 3, I realized, you know, he'll go to school in the not too distant future, and I should contribute to the family finances. My husband is a firefighter, and at the time he had 2 jobs, like most firefighters do. And I thought, I can't have my kids in full day school and just kind of be waiting for them to come home. So I should, you know, try to find something where I can work from home. And at the time, like, the hybrid model was not a thing, right? You would have to go to work. So I was thinking, well, I could bartend, right? I had like 3 life skills. And I thought, well, maybe I could write a book. And I thought, I'll write a book about ordinary people. I'll write it in a small town because that's where I grew up and that's where I live today. And I'll give them a really wonderful, heartwarming story. And so I took a year and a half to write my first book, Fools Rush In, and got an agent, got a publisher. The very last publisher that my agent queried was the one that signed me. And I've been under contract ever since, which is shocking when I think about it. I never imagined this would be my career. You know, I thought I'd write, maybe if I was really lucky, I'd publish a couple of books, and here we are all these years later.
Well, you say lucky, but I say it's probably a testament to your skill as a writer that you've been continuously published.
Thank you.
That brings us to your latest book, A Little Ray of Sunshine. What can you tell those who have not read the book yet about it?
Well, this book is set on Cape Cod in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, which is one of the most beautiful parts of America. You know, New England, coastal community, all these little inlets and tidal flats and charming little downtown. And our heroine is Harlow Smith, who runs a bookstore with her 90-year-old grandfather. And she has a very curated, quiet life. She's got her dog, her grandpop, her store. She plays on a trivia team. And she says, that's great. I have everything I need. She's the oldest of five. There's always something going on in the family. And then one day, someone walks into the bookstore and it's the child she placed for adoption almost 18 years ago. And she instantly recognizes him. And she's so overcome that she actually faints right there in the store, having seen her son for the first time since the day he was born. So Matthew kind of lobs this bomb into her life, and she's so happy to see him and to see that the couple she chose for him loved him and nurtured him and supported him. But his parents didn't know he was planning to meet her. This is a surprise to them too. He's chosen the family vacation in Cape Cod with, you know, his hidden secret reason. And so his mom, Monica, who raised him, also has a point of view. And so her summer is turned on its head too, because suddenly there's this new shiny mom and her family and this beautiful setting. And, you know, they both have to kind of reassess what their role in Matthew's life is and make space for that other mom too. And of course, there's a love story, you know, this delightfully nerdy marine biologist, Grady, who went to school with Harlow and took her to the prom, who has now become kind of a hot single dad and plays on her trivia team and makes it very complicated for Harlow since he is a dad and has a little girl. And she's in the middle of this kind of chaotic summer of discovering her son.
What prompted or inspired you to use adoption as a theme in the story?
Well, I love to get my ideas from regular people, you know, and I have adopted people in my family. My father was adopted by his stepfather, and he never knew his biological father, which had a huge impact on him that I never was able to fully explore, unfortunately, because my dad died young. But he yearned to know his biology, his genetic history, to know more about his dad. He had a wonderful stepfather, and you know, that experience was lovely, but it still left something wanting in my dad. And my husband and I also came fairly close to adopting a child in an in-family situation where I was actually pregnant with our second child, and a family member who was a teenager got pregnant. And we said, you know, if you are thinking of adoption, we would love to raise your child and you could still see him and be part of his life. So for about a month, we talked about that, and we were ready to have, you know, two babies in the space of a couple months. And the day he was born, she decided to keep him and raise him. And so every time I see that young man, because he's now 24, I think, what a great kid. It was the right choice for my cousin to keep him. But also, I think, well, you know, you could have been my son. And so there's this kind of poignance there. So I want to always make things as difficult as possible for my characters, you know. So I wanted Harlow to be in this position of this agonizing choice of, I could keep this baby. My parents would help me raise him. This would not be a bad life for him if I kept him. but would it be the best choice for him? Is it selfish of me to think, well, I want it, you know, I want to keep him. And also I don't want to keep him. I want to finish college. She's only 17 years old. She's a freshman in college. And it's, you know, it's one of those moments where both choices are wrong and both choices are right. And I think that that makes a really compelling read to think about the path not taken and what life could have been like then.
Yeah, your stories, all of your books are always so nuanced. It's not just black and white or one way or the other. There's choices, and they can be difficult and easy, and they all have an impact on the characters. You'd written, I had to write it down, motherhood is the toughest job you'll ever love. And yes. Mother is one of the themes also woven into the story. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I'm lucky to have two grown children now, and they are both responsible, kind, happy people. So, you know, I pat myself on the back and I think we made it, you know, we did it. Shoo. But also, you know, every day of being a parent is difficult. Every day you put your children's needs first, one hopes, and you have to search yourself for wisdom and patience and creativity. And you have no map and no book that will tell you how to do it. You have to live this experience, and you never know if you're doing a good job or not. And the funny thing about kids is they're really good at keeping score. You know, so they'll let you know the times that you messed up, or the times that you embarrassed them, or lost your temper, or made them feel bad. So I think especially like in this generation, my generation was probably the first generation to think about how we were raised and to question it. And then the Gen Zers, they're just so savvy and with it, and like most real-time feedback on how you're doing as a parent. And you want to say, this is a hard job, cut me a little slack, you know. But it's also, you know, it's the most wonderful thing in the world, you know, to be a parent, in my opinion. And the greatest thing I've ever done is be my kid's mom.
One of the things that I think you do brilliantly in A Little Ray of Sunshine is you show readers that there isn't one flavor of motherhood.
Right.
It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I thought that was really, you did it in such a deft way, because between Monica and Harlow and the people in her life, it's, you can't just say biology makes you a parent, or nature, all those things. I mean, what works for one person doesn't work for another. But how did you decide you wanted to show those different facets of motherhood?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of adoption, as you know, the daughter of an adopted person and the niece of an adopted person. You know, I think adoption is a wonderful option if it's the right circumstances. And I wanted to present the layers and the nuances of child rearing. If you are a biological mother, if you are an adoptive mother, if you're a careless mother, if you know, there's quite a few moms in the story, and they all have their different style of raising a kid. One mom wants a little mini me in her daughter. She, you know, she adopts her child in the late 50s. Early 60s that she adopts her child, in an era where you could go to an orphanage and leave with a child. Mm-hmm. And that's how my uncle was adopted out of, you know, his parents visited and picked him out because he was adorable. And that was that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have this woman who wants to shape a child into her own image. And then we have Harlow's mom, who's sort of a fan of the free range children school of thought, you know, where you shove them out in the world and see how they do, they'll probably be okay. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of how I was raised, you know, as long as we came home for dinner, mm-hmm. we were fine. It didn't matter what happened between breakfast and dinner, you know, what dangers we were in, what people we were hanging with, as long as we showed up alive at the end of the day. So, I did want to look at what makes you a mother, what makes you a good mother, how your best intentions don't always play out. I loved writing the character of Monica because she is so careful and so measured, and she does everything right. And then her son says, surprise, you know, I met my mom today, and she's not even on the same coast when this happens. And she's devastated that he cut her out of this hugely important event in his life. And it was funny, my daughter was reading the book and she said, yeah, Monica, boy, she was really, you know, she was uptight. So, but really, I thought she was a lot like me, actually. And I thought, you know, yes, you know, you try to be careful and you try to do the right things and you read the literature and you try to make the good choices, and still you'll screw up. I mean, that's one thing that's guaranteed. You'll mess up your kids somehow, and that's what therapy is for. They all want to know about your moms, right?
Well, I thought what you did that made Monica really endearing to me was she isn't perfect, but she's doing the best she can. And in her family, she has to be the organized one and the structured one, the one that sets down rules and the one that makes sure the trains run on time. Because if she didn't, everything would kind of fall off the wheels.
Right. And there's a lot about, you know, the nice parent and the other parent, you know, the one who
the fun makes parent.
Homework. Yeah. And you know, she's also the breadwinner in this family. Her husband, the lovely Sanjay, is a teacher and beloved and kind of the easygoing one. And he gets to be around the kids more because she's in her very high pressured job, supporting them and providing for them. And there's, you know, I think with a lot of working moms, myself included, there is that conundrum of, you know, if I work out in the world, in one sense, I model what it's like to be a person, not just your servant, your chauffeur, your cook, but also I have a role and an identity separate from just being a mom. And on the other hand, she yearns to just be a mom and be at home every day and make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and hang out with the kids. And she can't do both, not simultaneously. And, you know, that weighs heavily on her. You know, what am I doing the right thing for my family? And I think that's a very common problem.
It is. One of the other things that you had said in the book that I thought was really smart was, if your identity comes from what you do for other people, who are you when you are alone? And in this case, you were referencing Harlow, and it really does kind of give you a window into her soul as a character. But what did you mean by that? How does that make us understand Harlow better?
Well, Harlow is the oldest of her five siblings, and she's the good kid, the responsible kid, the kid who will never give her parents any guff. She takes care of her little twin sisters and then her next sister and then her baby brother when she's 10. She has four little siblings, and she can give them baths and clean up the kitchen and babysit. And that's her role in the family, is the helper. And in a lot of ways, that's my role in my family too. So it was very, very cathartic to write about Harlow sort of as that kid that no one has to think about because they're fine. They're doing fine. They're studying. Their paper will be handed in ahead of schedule. They'll get good grades. And meanwhile, you know, your siblings might be a little more interesting or chaotic or troublemaking. And Harlow wonders about that as she chooses to go to college 2,500 miles away in order to see who she is when she's not one of the Smith kids, when she's not Jerry and Elsbeth's daughter, or, you know, just that nice girl, you know. Mm-hmm. She wants to see what it's like. And I think, again, that's a very common experience of, who am I away from my family? And if you take away me being helpful and responsible and, you know, you need a ride to the doctor, I've got you, you're sick, I'll bring you soup. Who are you when it's just you? And Harlow doesn't know that, because when she placed Matthew for adoption, she shut down a lot. of her emotional experience there. She refuses the post-adoption counseling that's offered to her. She immediately goes to a different school so she can start over. And she just kind of tries to pretend this didn't happen. And she has this mantra, you know, I did the right thing. He's not my baby. It's fine. I did the right thing. I don't have to think about that. And that catches up to her. And I think when Matthew comes to her store and is looking at her, all that breaks apart, all that control and that neatly curated life just kind of shatters. And she has to kind of take a look at not just who she could have been as a full-time mom, but who she is now as a result of all that suppression and all that sacrifice in placing her child, and who might she be now when all of those scales have fallen away.
Towards the latter part of the book, you also give readers another twist that kind of really gives more, even more dimension to Harlow, because she is given a choice and she makes a selfish choice initially, only to realize that she really needs to make a choice that's best for everyone and not just for herself in that respect.
That was I knew it was going there, John, as I was writing the book, and I dreaded that moment, you know, when she has to realize, like, what is it to be a mother? It is to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And it's gonna hurt. Mm-hmm. And it does.
Let's just say readers will want to stock up on Kleenex when they're getting ready to read.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be one of my books if I didn't make you cry a little bit.
One of the characters that I loved best, and that probably says more about me than you, is Cynthia, because I thought you did such, I mean, you're not afraid to give somebody who initially is like, what a total bitch, just for lack of a better word. And we all know those people in our life, you know, you work with them, you know them from church or wherever it is, and you just think, why is this person so unhappy? Why are they trying to make everyone else's life miserable? And that's how she starts out, but you, through your magic, turn her into something different. What about Cynthia brought her into the story?
Well, Harlow is a very nice, good person. And Monica is a very kind and hardworking person. And I thought, I want a little salt in this story. And so Cynthia is Harlow's cousin. She owns 25% of the bookstore, and she is Harlow's co-worker. And she kind of hates people. She is incredibly judgmental and very superior and condescending, very disdainful of the events that have led her to have to work in a bookstore on Cape Cod when her rightful place is somewhere else. And I wanted also, she is also adopted. So I wanted to give another view on adoption where she's from another era. And again, she was, you know, her parents visited the orphanage, left with her, and she never was told. It was not an open story. It wasn't discussed back then in her community, in her family. She finds out by accident and decides, well, I don't even care. I'm glad my mother gave me up. I'm so glad she didn't keep me. And she did the right thing, and I don't need to think about her anymore. And so, of course, she'll have to reckon with that during the course of the story. But it's really fun to write a character who voices your worst moments out loud, you know, her judging and her love of gossip and her craving to be important and seen. I think those are all really relatable characteristics, whether we want to admit to them or not. So as a writer, it's an absolute blast to create a character like Cynthia, who's not someone you admire, not at first, and see her journey and see how she will transform during the course of the story.
Yeah, I think that's, you mentioned that, and that's important for readers, that she starts out one way, but through your skill as a writer, she becomes a different person in the end. And you kind of understand why she was who she was when she started out after what she's gone through.
I mean, that's what I love about any character who gets a storyline in my books is, why are you the way you are when we meet you? And who do you have the potential to become? And in fiction, you get to have them become something better, a better version of themselves. Still a realistic version of themselves, I think. But what happens if you push away the beliefs that you held so closely and open yourself to something new? And in real life, that doesn't always happen. You know, the bitchy, judgmental person at church might die that way. But in fiction, you get to like hope for the best and have a more optimistic view on human nature.
Let's switch gears a bit and talk about setting, both on the macro level. Setting is so important to your books in this Cape Cod. What is it about New England, this particular area, that makes you want to visit it in your fiction?
Well, I grew up spending summers on Cape Cod, and my family bought a house when I was a little kid, back when it was affordable and a middle-class family could do that. It's now, becoming a lot more expensive up there, as are most beautiful places in the world. But there's something very magical about Cape Cod. There's this beautiful combination of vacation and the pleasures of summer, the riding your bikes and going to the beach and taking a boat out. And also the working class fishermen and service people who keep the Cape going. And so I love that kind of class combination of the locals, the vacationers, the townies, the rich people. And then there's also just the incredible beauty of Cape Cod. We have the National Seashore there, which means that the beaches from East Ham to Provincetown cannot ever be developed. And so they're very pristine and pure. The houses that are there can stay, but you can never build on that land again. There can never be a condo or a casino out there. And then there's that magical Cape Cod light where about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the air seems to turn liquid gold and the sky is so blue. You can smell the pine needles and the salt air and like the good fried seafood that's ubiquitous up there. And I think because I went there as a child too, it has that magic of your family's never happier than when they're on vacation, And so it is a very magical place for me. And I also think that as a New Englander, I know the sensibility of Yankees. I understand how we are. We're not like Texans or Californians or Arizonans. There's a distinct Yankee way of being. There's language and ways of being. And I love showing that in some of the trivia night scenes, where, you got a bunch of townies playing trivia against each other and that sort of Massachusetts feel of, everybody and everybody's your cousin or you went to school with them. So there's definitely that beating heart of mine, I think, belongs on Cape Cod.
And then there's the micro setting of the book, which is a bookstore that Harlow works in and owns. What made you choose setting a book in a bookstore, and how did you research it so that it would be real in the story? Because let's be honest, I've read books where authors write about bookstores and they get everything wrong. You've got almost everything right. So
thank you. Research is really important to me. If I haven't had that job or walked that walk, I will find someone who does and pepper them with questions and tag along. So the reason I chose a bookstore was because it really fit Harlow. Again, she is in some senses hiding from her past, hiding from her motherhood experience. And what better way to do that than surround yourself with stories, And It's also a bookstore her grandmother founded. It gave her a place to go after a crisis in her life where she could be useful, where she could bring the magic of books to more people, to carry on the family bookstore. I named it Open Book, you know, as an ironic twist, because she is full of secrets. And it's just so such a lovely setting, you know, to be in a bookstore, as you know, John, surrounded by books, looking at books, just smelling the smell of new print is really heady stuff. But I also know it's not a quiet, sleepy job where you sit around and read and wait for a customer to come in. And to learn about that, I went to my local independent bookstore, RJ Julia in Madison, and I had no idea what a beehive that place is behind the scenes. I go there as a consumer. I spend an hour, hour and a half there, get a cup of coffee, wander around, and I feel like, what a beautiful, sleepy, rainy afternoon this was. What a great time I had. And meanwhile, there's 10 people in the store making the events and unpacking the books and writing the shelf talkers and recommending the books and hand selling to everyone who comes through the door, you know, getting them to read something that maybe they've been dying to read, or maybe they don't know they've been dying to read. And to just kind of keep books in the culture, keep people reading for pleasure. And what a busy job that is. So hats off to you, Poison Pen.
Well, to all independent bookstores, and actually even chains too, like Barnes & Noble, I think do their part. Let's talk a little bit about secrets, because you brought that up, and secrets do play another important part in A Little Ray of Sunshine. As I read it in your latest book, they can be kind of a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. Telling someone a secret can make you more free, but it also makes you more vulnerable.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting the things that we choose to keep secret, and the reasons that we do. I think for Harlow, she never tells her family she's pregnant and she's choosing adoption because she's afraid they'll talk her out of it. And that in the end, she really believes that Sanjay and Monica will be better parents than she could be, even with the help of her parents and siblings, who would all be, you know, teenage aunts and uncles. Nothing against that. I have a bunch myself, you know. I have an uncle who's, you know, 2 years older than I am, 8 years older than I am. I was born on my uncle's 8th birthday. but she keeps that secret out of a sense of self-protection, and also to protect her family from that heartache of knowing that there's a baby out there, a child out there, a teenager out there who could have been part of their family. And what it does to her, I think, is it shuts her down. She tells her one friend this secret. And Rosie, her best friend, does come back into the story, the college roommate who saw her through her pregnancy, and then comes once Harlow is discovered by Matthew. Rosie has a secret too. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, we all have secrets. We all have those things that, you know, we think, like, with a gun to the back of my head, I don't want people to know these things. I would not reveal these things. They're too embarrassing or shameful or deeply personal, hurtful. And the power that they hold over us is really, really impressive. And I don't think we know that until we start letting them see the sunshine and see what happens when those secrets are out.
Let's talk about your writing process for a little bit. Is it the same process for each book? When you start a book, does it vary? How do you go about creating these little masterpieces?
Thank you. The process varies. I would love to be that author who says, you know, I will write 4 pages every day, and then in 100 days, I'll have a finished product. That never happens with me. I work on my books every day, and I usually come up with the idea of, what if you were an adoptive mom or a birth mother and your child found you? What if you're an adoptive mom and your son found his birth mother during your family vacation and, you know, kind of blew up that last summer that he would be spending home? And then I build the story from there. I have a pretty good idea of how it will end, you know, in general terms. But the rest is the Wild West. I try to plot. I do have outlines. Generally about 200 pages into the book, the outline is no longer relevant. I'll think, you know, oh, this character should have a point of view, or that character should not have a point of view. And then by the time I'm in the middle of the book, in this big hot mess, I start to see what's going to be successful as a story, as a character, who should get to speak, and what should their arc be, and how to carry the story through this time period. In this case, it's like June to about October, December, I would say. And, you know, what are the events that will happen during this summer? And I generally, you know, I work very steadily. And then about, I'd say the last month of my book, of my deadline, I'm furiously writing, because now I know everything and I know how the book should be, and I have to go fix all that other stuff or delete it or rewrite it, which is what I'm doing right now. Number 24.
You have been writing for a number of years. If you could go back in time to when you were first starting out, knowing what you know about the book business, what advice would you give yourself? What would you tell yourself?
Oh, that's a big question. I think it would be concentrate on the things you can control, because most of your career is not in your control. It's in the reader's control. You know, I became a successful author based on no marketing, just on my book being out there and people saying, I loved this book. You should read it. It's really funny. I loved it. Readers make you a bestseller, or they don't. Your publishers will change their minds, you know, every couple of months about the way you should be marketed, packaged, edited, when your book should come out, when it should be reissued, what kind of cover you should have. So a lot of the business is beyond your control, but what I control is my book, my content, my story, and that's what should get most of my attention. It's really hard, you know, as you know, John, like there's so many elements to publishing, and I think you have to really safeguard that little bubble of creativity where you and your voice and your story is being told, and you're not paying attention to what's really popular right now. And one of the things that readers might know is that a book often takes 2 years to get to market. So you write it, and then it's edited, and then you get a cover and maybe a marketing plan, and then a release date. And by the time it comes out, you know, maybe you've written the best vampire book ever, but vampires are dead by the time your book comes out, you know,
or really, yeah.
Rom-com, and rom-coms are dead, and now it's gothics, or gothics are dead, and everybody wants, you know, spies or high drama or domestic noir. So it's really up to the author to kind of just do their thing and shut out the other voices. So I think I've been pretty good at that. It varies from time to time, you know, like any business, it can be stressful. And, but, you know, when I'm here in my office on my little green couch where my cat is currently sitting, there's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like being with your story and saying, wait a minute, that's all wrong. I'm going to fix this. I got her. Now I know her. I'm running with this. It's really the best job.
What would you say is the difference between being a writer and being an author?
I think the writer is the one who, you know, doesn't shower for 3 days running and has the goofy hair and forgets to eat and then goes and eats, you know, 11 Hershey Kisses for breakfast, you know. That to me is the person who's not paying attention to the outside world and is just alone with the story. Being an author means, you know, your public persona, in my opinion, means like putting on earrings and making sure I have, you know, my shirt on right side. And I mean, that's a wonderful thing too. Like, I'm on book tour now and interacting with readers and seeing people who have chosen to come to listen to you, to get your book, to have it signed is such an honor. And I try to respect that by being well-dressed, clean, entertaining, prepared, you know, and to let people know just how much it means to me that they choose to spend time with not just my books, but sometimes with me, and what a thrill that is. So, you know, same coin, different sides. Mm.
Is this your first tour since the pandemic?
I did a few local regional things last year, but yeah, pretty much it is, and it's wonderful, and it's so flattering to see, you know, people coming out and standing in line for 45 minutes and asking to have their picture taken with you. It's so thrilling. I mean, it's my 23rd book, and I'm still amazed that people want a picture of me. So, thank you.
Now let's take another turn and talk about Kristen as a reader, because early on you were a reader. In fact, you were not only a reader, but a dealer in books, if I remember correctly.
My dad was a printer. He printed books for museums and you know, universities and stuff. So we always had gorgeous books in our house. I never worked in a bookstore though.
No, but you had like a sideline in school.
Yes. Okay. I had the black market for romance.
The black market for books.
Yeah. In my high school. I went to a Catholic girls' school and I was the one who would come in smuggling the Johanna Lindsay, Julie Garwoods, Kathleen Whittiewis. I loved that. You know, I was such a reader, and my reward for getting through my homework and my Latin declensions and algebra was to read, and especially at the time read romance, which was, you know, just this whole other world of adventure and love and sex and, you know, different time periods and everything. So yeah, it's funny. My launch began this book tour at my old high school, and my former principal, Sister Mary, came. And you know, I just wonderful, hugely influential woman in my life, and I was really proud to be a Mercy girl. But yeah, I did have that black market, and it made me very popular in high school.
What have you read recently that you'd like to share with others? What is on your summer reading list for you?
I just ordered Henry's Sisters by Kathy Lamb to listen to. It's on my Audible. And I have T.J. Newman's latest book, Drowning, lined up to read when I go to the Cape at the end of this week. I read a fabulous debut by KJ Michiki called The Book Proposal, which was so entertaining because it's about an author and she's struggling to write her next book and has no ideas. And she, you know, late at night after a few glasses of wine, emails her high school crush and they get to talking and he says, "Oh, I've got a story for you. You could use my crazy ex-girlfriend in your book." And there's this really wonderful plot twist that I won't give away, but it was so funny and so fresh. I really loved that, The Book Proposal. Denise Williams wrote Flight Delays and Other Temptations. And that was one of those books I thought, why didn't I think of that? That was such a great idea. Three couples, it's three novellas in one book. They all meet at the airport. And as a traveler, I loved that. I love airports. I love people watching And that was really delightful. I've read some nonfiction this year. It's been a great year for books for me. I've just, you know, there's just been so many wonderful books that I've stumbled on. I do read pretty broadly. You know, I read Prince Harry's memoir. I read romance. I read women's fiction. I read horror. It's been a really good year for books.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, when you're not reading and writing, I don't know if it's still true, but at one point you did have a podcast. Is that correct?
I do. I still have my podcast with my best friend, Joss Day. It's called Crappy Friends, and it's kind of a very poorly engineered podcast where Joss and I sit around, usually my kitchen table or hers, and we pour a glass of wine and we talk about female friendships, because I think they're so important to women. I know a lot of my friends and myself included, our husbands don't need friends. They have their wives, they have their partners, they have a brother or two, you know, but we women need our friends. And when something goes wrong, it's really complicated and distressing. And so Joss and I started this podcast 5 years ago now, and we read a letter and weigh in and, you know, sometimes have a guest on, one of our friends, or occasionally my daughter for the youth perspective. And it's a real labor of love. And we do have a book called Crappy Friends, The Ultimate Guide to Female Friendships. But it's just kind of an endlessly fascinating field, women and their friendship woes. So I do that. I love to garden. I have a grandson now, so I do a lot of following. You know, he's toddling around the garden and he loves to look at the wheels of my car, and you know, his first word was tractor. So we spend a lot of time with him, and I love to travel. My husband and I will be going to I'll be going to the Cape quite a bit this summer, but also to the California National Parks. We'll be hitting Yosemite, Lawson, and Redwoods this fall. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. It's kind of like the carrot to finish my current book, toss it over to my editor, and then quick, get out of Dodge.
Are you willing to, and you don't have to, but can you share anything about what's coming next?
Yeah, the next book will also be set in Wellfleet, and it's another Smith family member. So it's one of Harlow's younger sisters and her story. And again, it's got some tragedy in it. It's got some great humor in it. It's got a very beloved trope in romance and women's fiction, which is a pretend relationship. Oh. So I'm really enjoying writing this one.
We do have a few questions from some of your online viewers. The first one, the person would like to know what input you have when it comes to selecting titles for your books, and what does A Little Ray of Sunshine mean to your particular story?
Oh, I love that question. in this book, A Little Ray of Sunshine is, I love to have kind of weather references for this book series set on Wellfleet. Out of the Clear Blue Sky was the first one. I had Pack Up the Moon. Little Ray of Sunshine, I think in this book refers to, you know, that warmth and that love that Harlow has for her child that she has kept very tight, real tight focus there. Can't think about it too much or it'll be too overwhelming. Just that moment when you let that little ray, you know, fill up your world and turn it golden and change it. So my book titles are chosen by committee. I didn't know if readers know this, but I think only once or twice have I suggested a title and my team has said, yes, we love it. That's great. Most of the time we will think about what will the cover look like, you know, like Sunshine, that makes a great cover. It's very sunny and cheerful. But I might give like three or four suggestions. My team might give three or four more. We bat them around. We talk to the art department about how would you represent this on a cover, and then kind of go with the most popular one. I have definitely turned down titles. I thought like, oh, that's really, really dull, or, you know, that doesn't sound right to me. Yeah, it's a process.
Another online viewer would like to know, when it comes to writing your stories, do you have to know the names of all of your characters before you can tell their story, or can you just add those in later, I guess?
It's funny, some of my outlines will have like the name as like ABC. The name is actually really important to me, as I think names are. As a parent, you know, you struggle to find the right name for your kid, or you hear someone's name, you're like, oh, what's that person going to be like with that name, you know, spelled that way. But names are very informative to me. And in the Smith family, you know, with a last name like Smith, the mom wanted to be a little bit creative with the kids' names, and she picks out Harlow's off of a gravestone in Boston. She just thinks, Harlow, that's, oh, I like that, you know? And I do think that names kind of shape us in some ways. And I don't know, John, you have John, the classic man's name, you know? I have Kristen, which was very popular for my era, but is also Kristen spelled the way mine is. That's my mom's maiden name. Oh. So I'm very proud to have that as my first name. And she said, there were no other Kristens when you were born. I swear I didn't know a single one, but I was one of three Kristens in my class, you know. Mm-hmm. So I spend a lot of time on names. I will also, for the secondary characters, I will ask my readers, can I use your name? You know, raise your hand if you think that's okay. And so a lot of my books are peppered with the names of Facebook and Twitter followers who have offered up their names. And sometimes, you know, I'll get this fun request of like, you know, I want to be really mean, or I want to have a great ass. As long as I have a great ass, I don't care what you do with me. So it can be a lot of fun to use somebody's real name and then have them surprised when they come across it in the book.
Another viewer wants to know what your relationship with social media is like as an author.
It's wonderful, because it's such an immediate way to connect with readers. Even if I just like click the heart button, you know, they know that I've appreciated what they had to say. I have a very big Facebook page, and then I have a smaller group called Kristen Higgins Super Readers, where it's a little bit more intimate. Like I might say, should I color my hair, you guys? or, you know, what do you want to hear about when I'm on book tour, and get a little bit more intimate feedback. I'm on Instagram pretty regularly, and I try to post things that I think my readers will want to see. You know, here's the street where Harlow's bookstore would be, or here's the restaurant where they play trivia, or here's a picture of my dog sitting on my lap while I'm trying to work. So I think I'm very authentic on social media, because I don't know another way to be. You know, I don't really have, you know, that Instagram life. I think some of my most popular posts are me in my natural state of, you know, wearing pajamas and having crazy hair, looking grouchy because I'm not caffeinated enough.
Another viewer once loved the book. They said they loved The Ray of Sunshine, and they loved the trivia scenes. And they want to know if you're a trivia player yourself.
Yes, I am. I'm not a frequent trivia player. I don't belong to a team yet. I keep bothering my friend in Providence, Rhode Island, to let me join her team. It's a little bit far. But I had never gone to a public place to play trivia before. It had always been like family nights and that kind of thing. And we are a cutthroat, bloodthirsty family when it comes to board games. So I went out to like the local sports bar for a trivia night with my husband, and we didn't know anything about how to play, you know, how it worked. And we wiped up the floor with those other teams. We just so dominated. And my husband was like, you're amazing, honey. I mean, the things that you can pull out of your brain, just, you know, that's the fun part of it. It's like, how do I know the winningest quarterback in the NFL? I have no idea, but I did. Before Tom Brady, too.
That is amazing. Before we run out of time and we're rapidly approaching that point, how can readers learn more about your books? You mentioned you're on social media. Do you have a website?
I do, kristenhiggins.com. And I have, you know, my appearances are on there. So if we get a chance to meet in person, that's always so lovely. I have a blog that I probably do once or twice a month about, you know, adventures and in life, sometimes very poignant, sometimes very funny. And my next blog will be about an incident on book tour where I was like trapped in an intersection, trying desperately to get lunch, risking my life to have lunch at this crappy little Mexican place. So kristenhiggins.com, and then I'm on Facebook at Kristen Higgins Books, and, you know, my name, just pretty much wherever you look for social media, but all the links are on my website. So I'd love to connect with you.
Well, this has just been a real delight. The Poison Pen is thrilled and honored, as I am, to have Kristen Higgins here with us virtually for her new book, A Little Ray of Sunshine. I'd like to thank Kristen for joining us today. Oh,
thank you, John. It was so nice to chat with you again.
I'd like to thank everyone who's tuned in to another virtual event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. We look forward to seeing you again in person or online. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.